I'll introduce myself again. I'm Mohammed Ghannam, and I'm a Palestinian refugee from Gaza. I used to be the spokesperson for the Palestinian camp, and now I'm the spokesperson for Palestinian Liar Organization, because we had to remove the camp on the 6th of this month, September, and this was the last day of the Palestinian camp as in this form, as a demonstration started on the 5th of April last year and lasts until the 6th of September 2012, to be the longest demonstration for a group of people, longest political demonstration against the asylum policy in Norway. The main and the hugest support for this demonstration was and still from the Norwegian people, not from the government, of course. I'll start my presentation with small brief, I hope that it's small, about the background of the Palestinian situation and the Palestinian territories. And we will start from something we call in Arabic a Nakba. Nakba in English means catastrophe. And it's the day when, in 1948, when the Palestinian refugees, when the Palestinians became refugees, the majority of the Palestinians became refugees, and it was the start of having the conflict as an Israeli state and Palestinian refugees, Palestinian population who has no state, struggling to have a state. The only promise came from the United Nations at that day that the Palestinian refugees will go back to their lands in 15 days. But so far, after 65 years and more, we still waiting for this promise to be real. This is a small map. I hope that it's clear enough to understand the difference happened after establishing the Israeli state, and the majority of Palestinians became refugees in Syria, the West Bank, Jordan, Gaza Strip, and started the United Nations started establishing the refugee camps in the areas around the Palestinian territories in general. Those refugee camps, as you see here, those small dots, it shows the refugee camps that United Nations established for Palestinian refugees. Today, the situation is that there's more than 6 million Palestinian refugees all over the world. The majority of them are in the Arabic areas in Jordan, Syria, and Lebanon. And the worst situation, worst conditions for Palestinian refugees are in the Palestinian refugee camps in Lebanon. This is the small example about what happened for the Palestinian land, according to United Nations partition plan here in 1947. It was supposed to have this two states solution, but the situation now is less than 12% of the Palestinian land is called Palestinian occupied territories, with separate places according to Oslo Agreement. In the West Bank, as example, there's Area A, Area B, and Area C. Area A, the small red areas here, it's areas under the full control of the Palestinian Authority. Area P is under the full Israeli rule and under the civil Palestinian rule. And Area C, it's under the full control of the Israeli Authority for civil affairs and for the governmental affairs. And it means that Palestinians are not allowed to build or go to their farms or do whatever they want, except having a permit from the Israeli authorities, and this is almost impossible to have. Here, a small map showing more than 500 checkpoints in the West Bank. cutting the post tank for pieces. Those dots, it's the main checkpoints in the West Bank. And there's the majority of the other checkpoints are, they call it flying checkpoints, flexible checkpoints. They can just move it every day. Someday it's there, tomorrow you will find it on the other side of the world. But they say that because according to Oslo Agreement, they are trying to make it easier for the civil society to move. This is one of the main checkpoints in the West Bank, and you can see how crowded it will be, and maybe some of the results for the frustration will be this situation. The Israeli settlers are occupying the majority of the West Bank area. Settlements, as you see, they are armed, but they call themselves civilians, and they are there, of course, illegally, according to the international law. But so far, they are getting bigger and bigger. A small example about a small village called Akraba next to Nablus. There's a settlement called Itamar. Around this area, the majority of the houses were completely demolished. The farmers there cannot get access to their farms. The olive trees were stolen or sold and getting attacked, beaten, killed or injured from the settlements is something constant there, and it's something that because it's became usual, you will not hear about it even on the news because it becomes just a part of the daily situation there. Demolishing the houses by the settlers under the protection of the Israeli army, cutting the trees and stealing the rest of it. Maher Bani Jaber is one of the people who were living, or now he is living in Akraba at Nablus. He was arrested on the 21st of August this year. 1 week after deporting him, he got attacked from the settlers. And his main, the main reason for Una and his rejection was that settlers might not attack you again. But unfortunately, Una was wrong. The children's situation there, getting arrested, checkpoints will stop them and treat them like terrorists. They will have to show under their clothes, because the Israeli army is afraid if one of the children has has a bomb. Going to Gaza. As I said, I'm a refugee from Gaza. My grandparents were in a small village called Zemzem before 1948, and now it's a part of Israel. They moved to Gaza as refugees, and they were registered as the majority of the Palestinians as refugees in the United Nations files as registered refugees. So I was born, me and my parents and the rest of my brothers, as many of the families in Gaza and the rest of the world, we were born already refugees, registered refugees from day one. In Gaza, there's this blockade started, or the last circle of blockade started in 2007. There is no access for food, no medicine, no clear water to use as a human being. If you are lucky, you will have electricity 2 hours per day. And this is just the major part of the occupation. And there's another huge conflict, of course, everybody knows about it, the internal conflict between the Palestinian parties itself. The bombing is almost something became regular. And in the last 3 months, there was more than 20 attacks none of those attacks were mentioned on the Norwegian media, as example. But it's something happening every day, so it became usual to hear about or even to ignore it. Palestinian refugees, refugee camps in Lebanon. As you see, it's crowded. Those camps, since they were established, it's not allowed to extend. It's not allowed to fix your door if it's broken. It's not allowed for you as a refugee living in a refugee camp in Lebanon to go and study in the university, as example, outside the camp. The schools there are managed by the United Nations, and so you can get education until the secondary grade, and then everything will stop. This is, theoretically, it's a chance to go to school, but practically, because of the financial situation and the health situation and even the living conditions, it's almost impossible for the majority of the children there to go to schools. And the hugest fear there is the security, because those camps are full of militants, and there's always internal conflicts between the parties itself and also from the Lebanese government. There's a long list of professions that Palestinians there are not allowed to work with. From this camp, there was Ali Akar, Palestinian asylum seeker in Norway, was arrested on the 29th of April this year and deported to a refugee camp, Ain El Helwa refugee camp in Lebanon. Practically, he came as a refugee living in Lebanon, came applying for asylum in Norway for his own reasons, of course, because in Norway, as according to the asylum policy, they are not interested in the major situation. They are just interested in the personal story. And his personal story, just in brief, it's that he is a politically active in Ain El Helwa camp. And because of this, he was under a threat of being killed three times. The last time, his friend who was with him got killed. He came to Norway, stayed for 3 years, and then got deported to a refugee camp from a democratic country to a country, it's not his country. He's living there as a refugee, came to Norway asking for protection. Why we came to have Palestinian Lair in Oslo? Most of us haven't known each other before, as Palestinians came and started a demonstration on the 5th of April outside the parliament. The whole movement started on Facebook, on a small group called Palestinian Refugees in Norway. Started wondering about what's happening in the situation. We almost were ignorant in the policy here, because our interest is seeking protection, not moving to activism. But what we found out on the asylum centers in Norway, that there's people who are spending many years waiting for an answer from UDI and UNA, but the only answer will come after waiting for many years is just a negative answer and you are asked to leave. You'll spend the first year waiting for the first answer, and it will come a negative answer saying that Palestine is a safe country. Or for the people who flee out of the Gulf states for being stateless after the Gulf War, they can go and try to get a visa to Dubai, as example, or any other country. Or the situation in Lebanon is stable. The situation in the West Bank is getting better. And the land info reports are saying that the situation is getting better and the settlers might not attack you. The checkpoints are getting lower and there's more flexibility in the movement in the West Bank. But all of this is just theoretical, because even about the land info reports, we got lots of reports from human rights organizations working on the areas in the West Bank and Gaza Strip, telling us that the information we gave for land info were not published. And the only information that they were published are not real. They are not touching the reality of the situation in the West Bank. It's talking about some areas here or there, but the major situation is completely different from what they are saying. So it's a complicated argument between a government saying that our main base for the information is Landinfo, and human rights organizations are saying that this is not right. And again, for the Justice Department here, saying that the system is perfect and it's working, and you are getting negative answers because you do not deserve asylum. You do not deserve protection, because if you are saying that you were tortured by Hamas in Gaza, we are saying that the torture is not systematic enough to ask for protection. Those are registered answers from UDI, and the negative answers for some people from Gaza. If you are from the West Bank complaining about the settlers' attacks, they might not attack you again, because if they attack, they will attack, but the Israeli army now is working to stop those attacks. So they are depending on something might happen. So the practicalities in the situation and what we experienced in the asylum centers, we met people who are spending 8 years in the asylum centers with their families and their children without any answer from UDI or UNA, for example. And when they get the answer that it's a negative answer, imagine that you have children who was born in Norway and grown up in Norway, spent at least 3 or 4 years in Norway, knowing just Norway, nothing else, and their own fault that they are from immigrant parents. So they are not accepted by the system. They are even not allowed to be registered on the folk register when they are born in the Norwegian hospitals. So what's happening on the ground? Is there strange criticism for our humanity as human beings? We came seeing all of those situations. We have to wait and just get this 1,500 crowns in 2 weeks and just keep silent. When you get rejected the first time, it will be reduced to 900 crowns. And then you are not allowed to go to school to learn Norwegian. Because of this, I cannot speak Norwegian now, as example. I spent 2.5 years in Norway and cannot speak Norwegian, but I understand a little. You are not allowed to get the medical care. Because if I go to the hospital now and say that I need medical care, they will say, give us your personal number or the number. But as rejected asylum seekers, you will not have it. So no medical care, no education, no protection. And the only question is, when are you leaving? And then something else, that at the time that we are not allowed to get in the system, we are not allowed also to go out of the system from Norway because of Dublin condition, which means that if you are applying for asylum in Norway, you are not allowed to apply for asylum in any other European countries, and the same in the opposite way. So practically we became stuck in the middle. For the majority of us, we cannot be deported, at least so far. And this is against the wish of the Justice Department, of course, and the immigration police work. But for those people who cannot be deported, as example, they will have to wait for 10 years, 20 years maybe. There's people who are waiting for 22 years in Norway with no rights at all. If we are taking a small example about the situation in Lebanon, in the refugee camps in Lebanon, there's some list for professions you are not allowed to work, but here you are not allowed to work completely. There is some medical care comes from the United Nations in the refugee camps in Lebanon. Here we are not allowed completely to have it. The only access for medical care is the populous health care, and it's related to the church, and was criticized a lot from the Justice Department, that you are giving a medical care for people who are papillos and not allowed to stay in Norway. They are criminal. So this is the new way of dealing with us as rejected asylum seekers, that they are criminalizing us. The word criminal comes for a person that the only fault he did, that he is coming to ask for protection. So in this word, and with using the system that those people are illegal, and so they are criminals. It's allowed to arrest them and take them to Trandum and keep them there for a while until we can fix any papers for them. In the Palestinian situation, there was a cooperation between the immigration police and the Palestinian embassy in Norway to issue passports for one way for the people who want to be deported. The immigration police denied this many times, but then we came with a press release on our website, palestinianlive.no, and said that we have information saying that the immigration police is contacting the Palestinian embassy to issue passports for Palestinians, and there is list of names. They said no, there is no list of names. But then they changed their press release saying that there is list of names, but not from the Palestinian camp. It's for Palestinians in general. And then they deleted the whole press release, because what they are doing is a direct connection with an embassy here, and practically it's not legal. And when it became difficult to issue those passports, they started issuing laissez-passer, the United Nations passport issued for refugees to deport people, and they used this in Maher's case to deport him to the West Bank. But anyway, going back to the situation and how this demonstration started, it started with an invitation on Facebook. 120 Palestinians gathered outside the parliament with completely nothing. No plans for where to live, no plans from where to get money and eat, no plans for where to sleep. Blitz had the offer that time to offer their place for 120 Palestinians to live. But then when those people became secured for a while, the pressure started from UDI, saying that you have 3 days to go back to the system unless you are completely out of the system and you will be considered not under our protection. And this means that there is no money will be sent for you, no place to live, no food. And our answer was clearly that we are not here to seek money, food, and a place to live. We are seeking protection. Give us the right to live. We can work. We are highly educated people, having lots of resources. You will find lots of resources between us, resources that Norway really needs. And we can work, pay taxes instead of taking the country's money and being some ignored group somewhere thrown in a place called an asylum reception center in Norway, and having this fear of being deported anytime, and the constant pressure on our minds. So a person who's sitting in a small room with three or four persons and spending many years waiting for nothing, waiting for the day that he has to leave, and the fear of what is waiting there. Every one of us has his own reason to leave his family, to leave everything valuable in his life, to leave our work, our land, everything. We left all of this, came here asking for protection. We are not here asking for 900 crowns in 2 weeks. And all the talk from the government and from Paul Lundstedt, especially Paul Lundstedt as General Secretary for Asylum, that those asylum seekers are liars. How can you judge that those are liars? How can you judge that the situation in the Palestinian territories is different? And in many meetings with him, one time he said that, I understand that the situation in the Palestinian territories is difficult, but excuse me, there's more difficult areas than Palestine. But it's not an excuse. It's not an excuse to come and say that Mogadishu is worse than Gaza, so we should deport people to Gaza, they should go back. And it's not an excuse to come and say that they're using our money, because your system is wasting the Norwegian money on the asylum seekers sitting on the reception centers and wasting hundreds of thousands every day on deporting people. Because every deportation needs hundreds of thousands of crowns to do it. You will book tickets for two policemen to have a nice trip in somewhere in the earth. Those, they will go to hotels, and every deportation will cost around 250,000 crowns. And they are deporting at least three or four every day. I don't know how many deportations every week. And I don't know how many deportations every month and every year. So how much does it cost? How much does it cost Norway to do all of this? How much this system is costing Norway? And what is the result from this system on us? Why are you taking the responsibility for sending someone to hell if you don't want him inside your system? Let him go. Do not stop him on the train station saying that you're not allowed to leave Norway. You are just allowed to leave to the West Bank or Gaza Strip. You're not allowed to go to Sweden, as example. But if there's a chance there, why not? If the system here is closed on 5 million persons and there's a fear from the government that the population in Norway in 10 years will be more than what can we deal with them, and the money will reduce, so let them go. Do not say that all the asylum seekers are welcomed and here the place of the protection. But why we are here? Because we believe that the people's wish is much different than the government's wish. What make us stand up and stay for 1.5 years on the streets of Oslo is the Norwegian people, the Norwegian public, not the system, not the governmental system. The governmental system was pushing us and pushing hard to create criminals. Because if you are pushing on people to be isolated in those places, you are just telling them, go and do something wrong. Go, this place is not good for you. Those some hundred crowns are not enough for your own food. You cannot buy a jacket in the winter. So you will have to go and fix money from somewhere. What are the possibilities for this? The only possibility to get money is illegal way. So practically this system is creating criminals. It's not creating diversity. It's not making any easier integration. And the argument from the government is that some groups are easily integrated and the others are not. But if I am one of this group coming from Sweden, as example, with a Swedish passport, but with my Palestinian background, I don't think that the same thing will be said on me, that I'm easily integrated because I'm coming from Sweden or Polonia or whatever. But the feeling here that what happened in 2009 in changing the asylum policy was based on just governmental business. It's a political game. And we are keep saying this because the answer from Paul Lundstedt outside the parliament after 1 week of this demonstration started, he said that it is a game and it will end with one-way ticket. But if he considered the other's life is a game. So what kind of a system called the perfect system? How can they call it fair but strict? It's not fair and it's not strict. It's completely closed. And there's always excuses from the government that what's making us doing this is that we cannot open the door for all Palestinians, and if we say that Palestinians are allowed to get asylum in Norway, there's millions will come. But the reality is saying that during the war in Gaza in 2009, the maximum number of asylum seekers was 18,000 from all the nationalities. The Palestinians in Norway, since the first asylum seekers came, first Palestinian asylum seeker came on the 70th to Norway, until now there's 3,540 Palestinians. There's less than 100 Palestinian asylum seekers in Norway today. So there's no reality for this argument that there's thousands will come or millions will come to Norway. If millions will come to Norway, I'm saying as a Palestinian from Gaza, the Norwegian government they were cooperating with and occupied occupation authorities sending bombs to bomb Gaza during Gaza war, and this is something became public, and it was even on Anarco 2 months ago, that one of the most powerful weapons used in Gaza during the Gaza war were Norwegian weapons. The hugest factories and the West Bank and the settlements are managed by Norwegian money from the Norwegian people. The security for the settlements there is managed by G4S company, and it's a company working here for security also. So if you are saying that we are making peace there to make the situation better, we are saying, I'm saying that I'm a refugee, I want to be returned, but not for Gaza. I went out of Gaza because I don't want to get killed. I left my family because I want to stay alive at least, and calling them on the phone will be much better than being killed, and they will just come and visit me as a dead body. So if we are talking about returns, there's lots of areas now in Israel are completely empty. And the law, all the international laws are saying that Palestinians should be returned. Settlements are illegal. And if you cannot push on Israel as a state to have peace, at least you can stop your support for Israel as an occupation authority. At the time that the government is saying that we are working for peace and making peace, sending money for peace, yes, you're sending money for peace for the Palestinian civilians there, but at the same time you are making a cheap occupation in Palestine. You are supporting the occupation in the settlements. What's the meaning if you are saying that the settlements are illegal and at the same time you are supporting the factories there? And the excuse is that we want to make the trade movement is flexible between the Palestinian territories and the settlements. This is not an excuse, it's a crime. Those are the real crimes. It's not a crime to be rejected asylum seekers because of unfair system. The crime is supporting occupation authorities. The crime is sending people back to occupied areas, sending people back to a dictatorship in Ethiopia, as example. Sending people back, the last time they sent 6 children to Afghanistan, they're under 18, they were sent to Afghanistan, and the Norwegian army is struggling there. Yeah, thank you. I need it. Mm-hmm. 75 days for the Palestinians who were demonstrating outside the parliament were spent in Blitz place. After that, we established the camp on the 27th of May last year. Those are some of the reasons for rejections. I mentioned that you are a young man who can work, you should go and work. Or torture not systematic enough, or might not happen again, or settlers might not attack you again. This is one of the basic declarations of human rights, that everyone is entitled to nationality, but we are stateless. And even according to the United Nations recommendations, it's not allowed to deport people to occupied areas, but it's happening. So in a direct breach for United Nations recommendations, there's deportations happening every day. And the answer from the government is that we are following most of the United Nations recommendations. They are following 7 of 15. And the rest of the recommendations are, those recommendations are saying do not send people to this area or that people, that area or that area, but et cetera. Regarding the recommendation, especially about Palestinians, they are saying that it's since 2001 and it's old. The situation now changed because land info was there, and they are saying that the situation was changed, but the United Nations said again that as long as there is no change on our recommendations, it means that it's still valid and there is no change on the situation. But hopefully we will have the new version of this in January. So then it will not be old, it will be fresh, but for sure there will be an excuse from the government for this. The stateless situation means that there's no normal passport for you, even for people who are living on the Palestinian territories. We can have a travel document issued according to the Oslo Agreement from the Palestinian authorities, but it almost means nothing because you need a permit and the visas to cross the borders, even to Egypt and Jordan, the closest areas to the Palestinian territories. And for the situation for others, like refugees living in Lebanon, they will have a travel document from the Lebanese authorities just to prove their identity. The other refugees living in the, or used to live in the Gulf areas before the Gulf War, now they are completely without any documents. This is a picture for one of the demonstrations after arresting Mohammed Abarman, the first one who was deported from the Palestinian camp. What we were asking and we are asking now as an organization, an immediate stop of deportations of Palestinians, just a treatment for asylum seekers, the protection of Palestinian refugees in Norway. Thank you very much. I would love to just add a notice that there's on that table there, there's some visit cards like those on with the website and the email and some of the stories for some of the inhabitants and the former Palestinian camp, and you are more than welcome to have it. And if it's not enough, you will find all of it on the website. And there's a video, it's two videos. I don't know if we have enough time to show the video.
We have 20 minutes actually. So.
Okay, so we can show two videos in 20 minutes. We can, if there's any
we
questions.
We have some time for questions. We'll keep this also in English. We're of course aware that this is a touchy subject, so please be polite and respectful. And
be open, don't worry.
The last video you showed somebody who had heart failure. Is the person who said he's a computer engineer?
Yeah, that was me. I have a heart condition, yeah.
But you got treatment?
No. I'm still waiting for an operation.
And also another one is there was a woman and a child.
Yeah.
That was like a family. How are they living?
There's around 46 families here. Palestinian families in Norway as rejected asylum seekers, and it's the same conditions in the asylum centers, just waiting. If they are from the West Bank, they will be deported. If they are from Gaza or the Gulf areas, they will be wait until there's an open, being deported or an amnesty or something happens and a change in the policy in Norway. And the same situation for the West Bank is also the same with the Palestinian refugees from Lebanon, because now they can be deported.
Yeah. I'm wondering, actually, you mentioned Ethiopia and other refugees from other areas.
Can you speak a bit higher?
Yeah, I can speak louder. Do you also work with similar organizations for other refugee groups in Norway?
During our demonstrations and protests, I mean, for the last 1.5 years, we had many actions or activities together with other asylum groups. We had demonstrations together. We had projects like Atelier Populaire, Palestine Alive. It was a collective and solidarity movement. And there's also some plans. I mean, this was during being as a camp, and now we established an organization just 2 weeks ago, and the main purpose for the organization is protecting the Palestinian refugees and the asylum seekers in general. And we already opened new channels of communication and cooperation with the other asylum groups here in Norway, because it's one problem here for everybody. It's the policy, it's not the situation in the original countries or the people themselves. Thanks for listening.
And you were former neighbors to Jacob Church.
Yes.
Producer of music, as we heard. And as a university chaplain here at the campus, me and my colleague, we are working in Jacob Church every Sunday. And in your absence, so to say, we are still focusing on your presence. Your presence as a part of our society and as part of our fellowship. So, just wanted to tell you that you are in our thoughts. And this semester we have invited some students, some art and architecture students, to make some art pieces and artworks to focus on how to be a refugee and how to be in a fragile home and to raise questions about our inhuman society. So just wanted to know that you are in our thoughts.
Yeah, thank you very much. Thank you. And just to let you know also that we left the place, but we will be back soon in our activities. And to remind you, we had a festival last year in October. It was the first festival for the Palestinian camp. And this October, we will have the second festival for the Palestinian camp. And hopefully, it will be in the church also.
I'm wondering about, you said that you don't have any rights for medical support.
No.
And that the government has criticized the medical center for
Papinos.
But I'm a nursing student, and I just want to comment because I just had a lecture about this, and that as a health worker, there is no such thing as a criminal, that there, you can't criminalize health support for anyone. So, you know, all the Pilosa has the right for medical support and not being told to government. So health workers has no, it's not our job to report this to the government. Our only job is to give help.
I understand you.
Yeah.
I'm talking about the governmental decision and the issue from the governmental point of view.
Mm.
On the practical terms, we used to get some help even from the health center in Oslo, but it was as a personal help from the people there themselves. And sometimes we received the bills for the treatment, sometimes we even don't receive it. But it was something from the people themselves, because like I said, now the people helped and still helping.
Mm.
But the government criticized and,
yeah,
and still violating the human rights. So we believe that the problem is not in us as asylum seekers or in the Norwegian society as people, the problem in the system that makes this split between us. And it was extremely difficult because before the demonstration to communicate even with the society, but step by step we established successful communication with the society, and I think that it was one of the biggest movements we feel proud of it, that we broke this walls of ice between asylum seekers and Norwegian society made by the system.
But is it actually true that you can be refused to get medical help in Norway?
Yes, because if you, in some cases they will say that we cannot help you, there's no officially, there is no way to help you. But sometimes it happens that they give a temporary portion number just from the hospital itself as a help to help this patient if it's an emergency situation, like having to have immediate operation or something like this. But mainly it's not allowed.
But emergency help has to be allowed.
Yeah, emergency help is allowed.
Yeah.
But
it's also obliged.
Yes, but emergency help, according to the system also,
mm-hmm,
means that you are almost dying. Yeah, not in such a situation like my situation. As example, I have a heart condition, but I'm not dying.
Yeah.
So it's not an emergency.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I guess that's the dilemma here as well, what is actually emergency, what is actually necessary.
Yeah, but the main help as a direct help for asylum seekers, and it's mainly for asylum seekers, it's the health center for Papillosa. The help in the governmental hospitals is just a personal help from the people who are working there. But if you want to follow the system, there's lots of complications. Mm.
If the government doesn't want to give you paper, but the people want you here.
Yeah.
I don't know. I find like the, probably what is called the immigrant problem here in Norway, or the immigrant politics. Okay, like, probably even the government has been said to have been too kind in letting people just come in to Norway. In fact, they almost lost the last elections because of that, you know. This government, they feel they are too kind, allowing everybody to come in. And the people like, you seem to say now, it's enough, you can't take any more. So I don't know, which are the people you feel want you, probably the government probably is reacting to the people's cry.
I understand what you mean, but this depends on the way of mobilizing the asylum seekers' presence for the people, how the political parties will present this issue for the public. Most of the public does not have not met an asylum seeker before as a person. They just see them on the streets, but there's no personal communication with the asylum seekers. But when this communication happens, the result is that those people will feel that those asylum seekers are not a danger on their society, and they are not danger on the Norwegian money or Norwegian system or all of those thoughts about Islamizing Norway or there's terrorists are coming and blah, blah, blah. It depends on the knowledge. The major knowledge here that what the media is presenting. The media is presenting that there's someone raped a girl somewhere in Oslo and he was an immigrant. And then you will find a huge report about immigrants and asylum seekers and the percentage and who comes and who's here. But if you look, take a look on the police records, you'll find that 87% of rapists were ethnic Norwegians. And if you take a look on the numbers for asylum seekers or immigrants in general, there's around 600,000 immigrants in Norway. Most of them, now they have the Norwegian passport, but they're still called immigrants. And they are practically Norwegians, holding a Norwegian passport, living in Norway, speaking Norwegian, working Norwegian, living, everything is Norwegian for them. But and 180,000 of those are people from Europe working in Norway. So they are European, and those 180,000 that the government is saying that they are easily integrated, so it's okay for them to come and have to get a job from day one. The rest of the people from those 600,000 are from areas, if you want to count numbers, you will find that there's around 6,500 from Ethiopia, 6,500, almost the same number from Eritrea, and the majority of, or the biggest group here between immigrants in general, not asylum seekers, are Swedish, Polish workers, then Swedish, then Pakistani. And then you will find, no, not Somali and Pakistani. And then, and those numbers are between 26,000 to 38 or 40,000. And the rest of the groups are between 7,000 to 3,000. So if you take a look on the reality of the situation, the asylum center, seekers or the immigrants are not a problem, but it is a hot subject for politicians to go to elections. It's what they will talk about. They will talk about immigration. They will talk about money, petrol, if we should use 20% or 30% from the money coming from the petrol or not, or should we keep it or put it here or there. So what's happening regarding this situation, and is the knowledge, it's not the people. When we met the people, we found a huge difference between what we experienced in the asylum centers and what the people thought about us and what is happening really on the ground, that there's people who are having solidarity and supporting, and they are just saying welcome. And they see clearly that we need you. So it's I'm saying again that it is a problem in the system that gives this idea about asylum seekers, that the majority of them are criminals or ignorance. They are not easily integrated, and the diversity will be something dangerous in 10 years for Norway, all of those stuff, but it is just for the media business and for political business, nothing else.